Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Good afternoon. Welcome to today's webinar on the subject of R2V3, where we'll provide a very high overview or high level overview of the changes between R2 2013 and R2 V3. My name is Austin Matthews. I'm the EHS Assistant Program Manager with PJR. I have a brief agenda on this first slide as an introduction. We'll talk a little bit about Perry Johnson Registrars, who we are, what we do. We'll cover the benefits of certification to a standard like R2. We'll cover some transition details for clients who are transitioning from R2 2013 to R2 V3. We will cover the key changes and other related changes, again, at a high level. And towards the end of the presentation, I'll also provide an overview of the certification process for anyone who, rather than transitioning from the old version to the new version of R2, will be pursuing certification for the first time and may not be familiar with that registration process. So we'll summarize that as well. So PJR is one of the leading registrars in the world. We have certified companies to a variety of standards in a number of countries. So this is not an all-inclusive list, but gives an idea of our global presence. And again, we're able to grant certifications to a wide variety of standards. I do need to update this slide, and I will do so before we post it, but we have achieved accreditation to R2 V3. So that is another one that we can add to the list. Benefits of certification to a standard like R2. Certainly, the standard at its core represents a commitment to responsibly reuse and recycle electronics or electronic components. Going through the process of implementing and maintaining the management system for R2 drives improvements in environmental health and safety performance as an organization. The standard represents a framework for meeting customer and regulatory requirements. Also drives improvement or increases in management commitment and employee engagement levels to be maintaining the requirements of the standard. Being able to advertise an R2 certification can provide a competitive advantage or improve public image. Besides a competitive advantage, you may see other potential financial benefits depending on your area and the industry. In some areas, we see, for example, reductions in insurance premiums associated with organizations holding certain certifications. Maintaining the management system for certification can assist an organization in achieving their strategic objectives as an organization, or even their corporate entity's strategic objectives, as well as meeting potentially stakeholder requirements. The standard also allows for integration with other business management systems. As promised, I have some information related to the transition for clients who are certified to R2 2013 and will be transitioning to R2 V3. The final version of the R2 V3 standard was published last year. The final version is available through CERI's website, as is the REC and the Code of Practices that was recently revised. There's also a transition plan on CERI's website in regards to, again, this process of transitioning from R2 2013 to R2 V3. I mentioned the Code of Practices is available through the website that was recently revised. I think today the changes were published. We can expect an R2 guidance as well. Time for auditors and specifically certification body auditors, was built into the transition process. It's one of the reasons why you can see that we've achieved accreditation already, or that the transition timeline is staggered. We'll talk more about that in a moment. I mentioned the transition plan that SERI published. That's Advisory 22. So with the R2 2013 standard, rather than issuing revisions to the code of practice, SERI would issue advisories, which would essentially be revisions to the code of practice without revising the code of practice. So Advisory 22 specifically focuses on the transition from R2 2013 to R2 V3. It allows the transition audits to be up to 50% virtual or performed using remote auditing techniques. And that is at the certification body's discretion and based on whether the client organization has the infrastructure to support a successful remote audit. So that's at the certification body's discretion. The transition timeline is staggered, I mentioned. It allows facilities time to plan and trying to avoid overloading the certification bodies, with the majority of facilities trying to transition at the last minute or all in the same period of time. We have achieved accreditation, as I mentioned. PGR issued its own transition plan after SERI issued or published Advisory 22. This can be found on PGR's website. As with many previous standard transitions throughout the years with different standards, PGR included an internal deadline by which we recommend your transition audit take place. This is to allow a greater likelihood that there will be no lapse in certification. So if your audit takes place just a few weeks before the deadline to transition or the overall due date, this doesn't account for all of the other certification decision-making activities that have to be completed behind the scenes by PJR after the audit concludes. It's not enough to have your audit take place. We also need to resolve any NCRs through your corrective action process, have your auditor be able to accept those responses and the objective evidence of implementation. The package goes through a technical review process, and then the certificate department at PGR works on issuing a draft certificate to the client to proofread and verify its accuracy before the final certificate is issued. All of those things need to take place before the SERI deadline for transition. Otherwise, there will be a lapse in certification, a period of time during which the R2 2013 certificate has expired due to the deadline to transition, and that the R2 V3 certificate has not yet been issued. So if you haven't already scheduled your transition audit or thought about when that will take place, I highly encourage you to keep that information in mind. The timeline specifically is based on expiration of the R2 2013 certificate that an organization might hold. So the first bullet point relates to the initial deadline by which we had to cease as a certification body offering stage one and stage two registration audits to R2 2013. That deadline has already passed. So at this point, if you were pursuing initial certification to R2, if you weren't already certified to R2, you would be audited to R2 V3. And so that's already the case. We're not doing any more stage one or stage two audits to R2 2013. The second two bullet points relate to the transition expectations. If your R2 2013 certificate expires this year, this calendar year, you're able to recertify to R2 2013 one more time. Obviously, the audit needs to take place this calendar year, and you have to close the nonconformities before we issue a cert, which is always the case. And you will still need to transition ultimately by that same deadline. So you'll have a shorter certification period. It won't be the full 3 years. On the other hand, and this isn't listed specifically, but conversely, if your certificate expires after this calendar year, so sometime in 2022 or 2023, you'll need to transition at your next recert audit and or before the deadline of June 30th, 2023. That's the date that all R2 2013 certificates still out there will expire and will be withdrawn. I wanted to note as well that clients can transition to R2v3 during any audit within their cycle. It doesn't have to be a recertification audit. And for some clients, it will be a surveillance audit based on the deadline to transition and the fact that they hadn't already transitioned. However, the transition audit time prescribed by SERI is equivalent to that of a stage one and stage two. So even if it's a surveillance audit, it will be a longer audit than your typical surveillance audit due to the requirement to calculate audit time that way. This is to allow for auditing all of the core requirements and all of the applicable process requirements, which we'll talk about when we get into the standard specifics, but basically to make sure that it's a full audit to the standard requirements before you're issued a transitioned certificate. Before you're allowed to be certified to the new standard, you have to be fully audited against it. Once you transition, that audit will initiate a new three-year cycle. So if you transition during a surveillance audit, you'll have to decide whether you want your other standards potentially to be out of sync with the three-year cert you'd be getting for R2v3, or if you would want to realign them somehow during that audit or in the future. I have the same information on a timeline here. I just think a visual representation sometimes is helpful. So for certificates expiring on or after January 1st of 2022, you need to transition to R2v3 during your recert. June 30th, 2023, again, is the overall deadline to transition. The standard was revised for a number of reasons. I'm not going to go through these in a great amount of detail. There's a lot of material to cover, even in this one-hour high-level overview. So certainly, the standard was revised to take into account lessons learned from a variety of sources, feedback from a variety of sources. I think we can all acknowledge that the recycling industry has a lot of diversity in size and processing techniques, from a cell phone resale entity to materials recovery, smelting of circuit boards. So that R2v3 hopefully takes that into consideration more fully. Also to reinforce the requirements of the standard, making sure that they're effectively implemented across the board, consistently audited, that the language is clear, and trying to address or remove any sources of confusion. So I'm going to include my disclaimer here now. This is a free webinar, not a R2v3 internal auditor training. This is not a training offered by SERI. This is a very high level overview of the changes in the standard, the changes in the structure, some of the key takeaways for our clients to be aware of as they get ready to transition. This is not meant to replace a SERI training in any way. And ultimately, SERI is the go-to for any technical questions as to the requirements of the standard. So for R2v3, it's important to note that the original intent of the standard is unchanged. I have a screenshot on this slide of the table of contents, which right off the bat gives you an idea of the changes to the structure of the standard. So one of the key changes in R2v3 is the division of the standard into core requirements and process requirements, also known as the appendices. All clients pursuing certification to R2v3 will be audited against all of the core requirements. So everyone has to do all 10 core requirements. What is potentially not applicable to everyone would be the process requirements or the appendices. The appendices will be applied to each client organization based on their specific processes, the material that they handle, the processes they utilize on those material. We have downstream recycling chain management. We have data sanitization. We have test and repair, specialty electronics, materials recovery, and brokering. So this will be the shared responsibility of the certification body and the client to identify which appendices are applicable to a given client organization. The standard has greater emphasis on reuse. It's more prescriptive in certain areas, such as data security, testing, and repair. Again, we mentioned the need to, or the efforts to clarify requirements that might not have been understood previously or were ineffectively implemented. There are, with only 10 core requirements, obviously there are changes to the grouping and number of what would have been provisions in R2 2013. So those are now in the core requirements and they are restructured and scrambled and renumbered and regrouped. Another key change in R2v3 is the creation of the R2 equipment categorization document, or the REC, which goes hand in hand with the standard, and we'll talk more about that later. So again, this training does not replace a CIRI course or an internal auditing course, and with an hour, I can't do much of a detailed review of this. This is going to be a very high-level overview. However, I tried to make the slides fairly detailed. You can certainly download a copy of the slides from PJR's website after the webinar airs. We also record these webinars, so you can access a recording of today's webinar through PJR's website. You can utilize either of those to study the material in more detail. Certainly the verbiage is pulled from the standard, so I would also encourage you to obtain a copy of the standard if you haven't already done so. The introduction section doesn't have too many significant changes. We see references to the REC, which I already mentioned. You can download a copy of that document from the CIRI website as well. I think I have some screenshots of that towards the end of the webinar. We're going to go through the body of the standard first. The REC is used in conjunction with the standard, as I mentioned. It's essentially an outline of the requirements for evaluating electronic equipment and components, as well as categorizing them based on their condition. The REC identifies categories that are to be incorporated in the R2 facilities processes and procedures. So you can either use those exact categories or you can implement a cross-reference between the requirements in the REC and your existing process categories. So we have to be able to see how they align, how you've implemented those requirements. I mentioned that the process requirements or the appendices will be identified specific to your organization's processes. You'll also see those process requirements on the certificate once you are issued an R2v3 certificate. There's a lot of new terminology in R2v3. So again, download a copy of the standard and review those in detail so that some of the new terms make sense. R2 controlled streams, unrestricted streams. Those would be new terms in R2v3 that you'll want to really understand. Core requirement one focuses on scope. This is where we see requirements to include all applicable processes, types of materials, even external processes that are under the R2 facilities control, as well as all entity names. Remember that this is a facility-based certification, not a company-based certification. We also have to make sure we're factoring in services that take place outside of the facility, but are still related to the facility's operations from an R2 perspective. Things like off-site collection of electronics, mobile data destruction services, services that might be performed at a customer's site, things like that. The R2 certificate will reflect the scope, all applicable process requirements. There aren't any allowances at this time, so that won't be applicable right now, as well as all legal names and entities associated with certifiable activities operating at the R2 facility. Again, it's facility-based. There's also a requirement in this section to publicly communicate, has to be maintained on an ongoing basis, a list of all other locations that are not certified to R2, but are owned and or operated by the R2 facility and are used to manage used or end-of-life electronic equipment, components, or materials. So previously, you just needed to clearly communicate which were certified so you weren't implying certification to other locations, and now you have to be even clearer about that. This is meant to ensure that the certification isn't misrepresented. In sweeping statements regarding R2 certification, when an organization may have multiple facilities, only one or two of which actually hold the R2 certification. To be eligible for R2, an organization cannot have been identified by SERI within 2 years of certification in a list of organizations found to be marketing deceptively or fraudulently, have participated in illegal acts such as exports, things like that. So we'll also be monitoring this when we're evaluating transitions to R2v3 or initial certifications to R2v3. I mentioned earlier the intent of the standard hasn't changed, so no significant changes to core requirement 2, which is the hierarchy, except when it comes to references to the REC or different numbering of the core requirements due to the restructuring of the standard itself. Core requirement 3 covers the EHSMS requirements. It recognizes both OSAS 18001 and ISO 45001. This is not new. In the interim, you know, we're still seeing both. We should be almost done with that transition period, if not already done. So soon that will eclipse. This section also requires a process to periodically evaluate exposures to hazardous substances based on the types of material and the processing methods. High-risk activities such as materials recovery that we see in Appendix E would require even additional monitoring through their industrial hygiene program requirements. This section also specifies minimum accommodations and requirements for workers. Core requirement 4 covers legal and other requirements. The applicable legal requirements need to be documented and maintained, including export, transit, and/or import to demonstrate legality of international shipments. This applies to both equipment, components, or materials transferred by the R2 facility directly and R2 controlled streams, we see that term again, including shipments made by downstream vendors to final disposition or the first R2 facility. So we're looking at the legality of exports to end of life or the first R2 facility in your recycling chain. And this doesn't differentiate between needing to do it for shipments that leave right from your facility and not shipments made on your behalf or within your control that don't come through your facility. So keep that in mind as well. It also requires corrective action to address any compliance violations. It requires that the R2 facility notify their certification body if they receive a notice of violation requiring follow-up or action within 30 days. It prohibits child and forced labor. It prohibits prison labor except in certain circumstances or if certain criteria are met. It also specifies a non-discrimination policy requirement. Tracking throughput is covered in core requirement 5. This section requires a summary report be maintained for all transactions inbound and outbound controlled by the R2 facility. Again, whether they're taking physical possession or they're just contractually controlling those materials. Summary reports haven't been defined, but they'll likely require inbound and outbound quantities within a defined reporting period. It does, however, specify the contents for these records, such as accuracy of dates, detailed descriptions for all inbound and outbound materials. Total inventory levels need to be maintained below the limits required by the closure plan or other applicable legal requirements. You have to have a process for monitoring that or keeping the inventory below those limits if they apply to you. There's also a requirement in core requirement 5 to not store R2 controlled streams or materials with a negative value for more than 1 year. The exceptions to this requirement would be those components that have been evaluated and inventoried for parts for Appendix C test and repair, or where permissible, if items are stored beyond that 1 year limit due to a lack of response from the relevant governing authority to provide export approval, provided that everything that you were required to submit was submitted on time. Core Requirement 6 focuses on the sorting, categorization, and processing. This is significantly restructured, and this is where you see the majority of the references to the REC. This section requires a documented process for evaluating, sorting, and categorizing controlled and processed materials with a whole bunch of prescribed subjects to be included. The standard requires the R2 facility manage and process material as an R2 controlled stream until it's proven otherwise. So if it was processed and categorized by another R2 V3 certified facility, you can use the REC category that they identified. If it was processed and categorized by another facility not certified to R2 V3, but they have a documented and implemented process for evaluating, sampling, and verifying the categorization that the upstream provided, then you can categorize them accordingly. Another exception would be if you can prove as an R2 facility through appropriate testing or verification records that they're sanitized and functional, or if it ceases to be an R2 controlled stream via the definition of that term. So again, you really want to get familiar with R2 controlled streams, some examples of those, or how it impacts your organization, what that means given the types of material you typically receive. All equipment and components are to be evaluated for data with their corresponding status identified per the REC. This is important because, again, they're going to be treated as if they contain data until you can prove otherwise. Data evaluations are to include any connected user accounts and services. I already mentioned this already, but you need to control all equipment or components that may contain data per core requirement 7. So assuming that they contain data until you can prove otherwise. Equipment or components not permitted to be reused, sold, or donated per commercial agreements are still subject to the requirements of core requirement 7 and Appendix E. So even if you have a contract that says you have to destroy or recycle material, even if they have reuse potential outside of that contract, they still need to be processed according to core requirement 7 in lieu of treating them as if they did not contain data. Identification requirements for equipment or components evaluated and found to be capable of reuse are found in core requirement 6, and there's also references to the applicable appendix, which expands on some of these requirements. There are specific requirements as well for electronics or components that have been evaluated and categorized as an unrestricted stream. Again, you can take a look at the definition for that as well as the REC. Some of those requirements include handling them separately from the R2 controlled streams, being able to justify classifying them as an unrestricted stream. Tracking records have to be maintained, including any reason for returning those items or having had those items be returned. Just a few examples there. There's also specific requirements related to transferring functioning products where the functionality has been demonstrated according to the requirements of the rec. I'm not going to go through these in detail. Again, there's a lot of information in these slides and within the standard and associated documents. I just want to kind of give you a high-level overview of how the standard is structured and some of the key changes here. It doesn't specifically require physical labels if you have other means of identification and tracking. Core requirement 7 focuses on data security. It requires a data sanitization plan be maintained with procedures associated with it to address the prescribed subjects in this section of the standard. There's also an appendix that covers data further. There are a lot of requirements around data security. As I mentioned, this is an area where R2v3 is more prescriptive. So security controls, types of data storage devices. There's a whole lot in this section and in the related appendix. There's also a requirement for a written data security policy, including the need to assign a competent data protection representative. You can find that information in the standard. You need to assess the risk of theft and unauthorized access in terms of the security program. You're going to have levels of security permissions for controlled access relevant to the types of equipment received, the nature of the data you're managing as an organization, applicable legal and other requirements, etc., all of which needs to be authorized by that data protection representative we mentioned a moment ago. Also looking for written acknowledgments to be maintained for those granted security authorization, addressing their individual responsibility to prevent the release of data, report theft or data breaches, etc. This section also requires an incident response procedure for investigating potential or actual breaches, as well as to ensure notification of appropriate parties as relevant. The organization has to have a defined process for demonstrating that destruction processes are 100% effective. That's another change from R2 2013. Devices can be shipped or transferred for data destruction to a downstream vendor if there's a written contract in place and verification of the Appendix A requirements in instances where the sanitization or destruction is not being conducted in-house. So in other words, if sanitization or destruction activities are being outsourced by the R2v3 facility, there's additional requirements in Appendix A for vetting the downstream vendor who's going to do the sanitization or destruction on your behalf. The section also requires at least annual internal data security and sanitization audits to validate the data sanitization processes, and those need to be performed by a competent and independent auditor. It also requires a process for providing information to suppliers upon request, such as changes to downstream vendors that are responsible for processing data-bearing media, as well as security breaches. Core requirement 8 focuses on focus materials. It includes the requirements to demonstrate that recycling chains capacity or expertise in those areas, essentially their capability to process the focus materials being sent to them in accordance with the R2v3 standard. The section requires a downstream recycling chain flowchart when the R2 facility is not the final point of processing. You can find more detail in Appendix A. This needs to go either through final disposition or until the first R2 certified tier. Alkaline batteries that don't contain mercury would not be considered focus materials in R2v3. These would be managed under core requirement 2, as our previous expectation was for R2 2013. However, in R2v3, even lead-free circuit boards are considered focus materials. So that's another change. Core requirement 9 covers facility requirements. It requires indoor processing in most cases, indoor storage and labeling in most cases, appropriate insurance coverage, a closure plan that needs to include the use of appropriate commercial businesses to manage the electronics under their control. There is an exception to the financial instrument requirement in R2v3 compared to R2 2013. So if you meet all three of these bullet points, you are not required to hold a financial instrument to demonstrate the ability to cover closure costs in the event of abandonment, as was required for R2 2013. If the total closure costs are less than $10,000 and the size of the building is less than 1,000 square meters, all buildings, excuse me, and the R2 facility never accepts equipment or materials containing mercury, CRT glass, lithium primary batteries, or polychlorinated biphenyls, then again, if all three of these bullet points are met, you're exempt from holding a financial instrument to demonstrate the ability to cover closure costs in the event of abandonment. Core requirement 10 focuses on transport, the last of the 10 core requirements, references other core requirements as applicable. There's some additional requirements if you're going to be transporting data containing equipment or components, such as enhanced security measures and tracking. The section requires the accuracy of codes, descriptions, and declarations to ensure compliance with all applicable regulatory requirements are met. I'm going to continue quickly through the appendices so that we have enough time to get to any questions at the end. Again, the process requirements are not all going to apply to all R2 facilities. We'll be working with clients to identify which are applicable, and this will directly dictate the scope of certification, the scope statement listed on the certificate when PJR issues it as well, and this is a requirement of the Code of Practices. Appendix A covers downstream recycling chain, and I mentioned earlier, this section elaborates on the downstream due diligence requirements in a variety of scenarios. So you'll want to review this very closely. There's a lot of clarification and requirements in the appendix in addition to what's in the body of the standard or the core requirement. Whenever the Appendix A references an R2 certified downstream vendor, it's really important to note what they mean by that is R2v3 certified. So no longer will the R2 2013 certification count towards these requirements when we're talking about R2 certification. If you are vetting a R2 2013 downstream vendor, you're vetting a non-R2 downstream vendor for the purposes of the R2v3 standard. So this is going to be a challenge when companies are, or R2 facilities are first transitioning and perhaps a majority of their recycling chain has not yet transitioned. During that transition period, there's going to be a lot of additional due diligence requirements. Appendix B covers data sanitization, and based on a facility's processes, you may see logical sanitization, you may see physical sanitization, or you may see both. And again, the way the appendix is applied and the way the scope is written out on the certificate will reflect that. Again, in this appendix, there's a lot of specific requirements. You'll need to review this in depth There's additional data sanitization requirements beyond what's in core requirement 7. There's additional traceability and training and security control requirements. There's a table for physical destruction methods. There's specifications for data sanitization software requirements. There's a requirement for corrective action if there's non-conforming product or sampling issues. I'm trying to remember if there's another one. So this is just a high-level review, but there is a lot of information in these appendices. And if the appendix applies to your organization, you have to be meeting those requirements as well. Appendix C covers test and repair. Again, above and beyond the related core requirement are the additional requirements in the appendix if this applies to your organization. Appendix C requires, in addition to ISO 14001 and ISO 45001 or RIOS, it also requires a quality management system. So if you have to meet the requirements of R2-2013, if you already had RIOS, this won't change anything for you. You'll have to maintain RIOS. If you had ISO 14001 and ISO 45001, you'll need to assess whether you want to add ISO 9001 or whether you would like to add RIOS instead to fulfill the need for a quality management system certification. Again, this is specific to Appendix C and one or two other appendixes that we'll see as we go through. Appendix C requires a written R2 reuse plan, and it's really prescriptive in what it needs to contain. Again, we see the requirement to process materials within a year. There are a couple exceptions, and you need to maintain test result records for each uniquely identified item. Appendix D is for specialty electronics. If you have D, you have to have C, which means you also have to have a quality management system. Such as ISO 9001 or RIOS. There are some details in Appendix D in regards to the criteria or verification that would be needed in lieu of testing those specialty electronics. Appendix E covers materials recovery. There are additional EHS requirements for these higher risk activities, as I mentioned earlier. So in terms of hazard management and industrial hygiene, you see additional requirements in Appendix E if you're doing the materials recovery activities. Another requirement that is added in Appendix E is the need for pollution insurance. So not all appendices require pollution insurance. Appendix F is the other appendix that requires a quality management system certification, so ISO 9 or RIOS. So we have C, D, and F that require that quality management certification. This applies, the brokering appendix applies to entities whether the material is going through the broker facility or being sent directly from the upstream to the downstream vendor, but is under the broker's control. So it doesn't have to come into their own facility or for them to put their hands on it for that to be considered brokering. Most of you guys are probably already familiar with that. Downstream vendors still have to be managed per Appendix A under the brokerage appendix. That doesn't exclude the need to do the downstream due diligence. Specifically, broker facilities are responsible for core requirement 4, utilizing the REC, managing the transport of the R2 controlled streams throughout the recycling chain, data security and transport for core requirement 10, tracking throughput conformance for core requirement 5, and again, core requirement 10 in terms of packaging requirements for sellers and transporters. Core requirement 3 and 9 will not apply if they have the broker appendix and if the material never passes through their facility. So if they're totally, you know, physically hands off, then we can exclude 3 and 9, or 3 and 9 would be satisfied through those controls. Excuse me. The rec is fairly detailed as well. This is not auditable, but certainly is meant to be used in conjunction, and the clients, the R2 facilities, will be audited as to whether they've implemented those requirements. So the framework for evaluating electronic equipment components and materials and categorizing their R2 status throughout each step of the R2 process. That's how Siri refers to the rec. There are categories for cosmetic condition, functional condition, data sanitization status, and those are to be used, again, either exactly or through a cross-reference. Those terms are then to be accepted by other R2v3 certified facilities as well. Not all categories in the rec will apply to all facilities. It depends on the types of material that they're receiving and processing. And categories don't replace, or are not meant to replace, detailed descriptions for the purposes of certain types of documentation. I'm not going to go through the details for the rec today. I want to make sure we get some time for questions. But again, I've included them in the slides, and certainly the standard and the rec are available to be downloaded through Siri's website. As I mentioned, there are processing categories. There's R2 applicability, clarification between what's an R2 controlled stream and what's not, and how they get subsequently processed. This is a valuable reference in the rec. There's categories based on data sanitization status. There's functionality categories, cosmetic conditions, functionality descriptions, additional categorization details in the appendices of the standard. There's other related changes. The code of practice, again, was revised and just released today, so we didn't take the time to update the slides. It's going to take a little bit of time to unpack all the revisions in that latest publication that came out today, but that is available on Siri's website if you want to take a look. The R2 Code of Practices contains requirements that are specific for certification bodies, but also for clients and accreditation bodies, and some of the requirements trickle down anyway. So this is not an all-inclusive list. I just want to highlight a couple things. The Code of Practices requires that the certification body conduct a contract review before a stage one to R2v3, as well as before an R2v3 transition audit. So what PJR calls this process our contract validation. It's between a quarter day and a half day. It can be done off-site, but it is required by the Siri Code of Practice that we do that activity. That's not something that we came up with to charge you more audit time or anything like that. There's also changes made to the certification structure for different facilities and locations, the way different entity names interact. So you may see some new terminology there. Again, you can review that in the Code of Practices. For R2v3, you'll be allowed to have one surveillance audit per 3-year certification cycle conducted remotely. Again, this is assuming that you as an organization have the infrastructure to support an effective remote audit. But the limit would be, for R2v3, one surveillance audit per cycle. Another significant change is the need for evidence of correction for both minor and major NCRs. It also requires a revisit for all NCRs. So whether they're minor or major, they're series requiring a specific turnaround time in correction implementation. So it's not going to be enough to have an acceptable plan. We're going to have to verify the implementation of those within a specified period of time. Otherwise, the Code of Practices requires that we suspend the certificate until they can be implemented and closed. This is going to be a pretty significant change. Some things take time to address, so Just a heads up there. Plus the revisit piece I wanted to give everyone a heads up about. I mentioned that there are no R2 allowances for R2v3 at this time. There could potentially be some in the future. They have a placeholder in there for that. Okay, so that's a ton of information to go through. Again, please review the standard, review the rec, review the code of practices, take a look at the slides for this presentation where you can go through maybe more slowly and read through some of the information. I want to quickly summarize the certification process and then get to any questions that you guys might have. For an initial registration, rather than transitioning from R2 2013 to R2 V3, you'll need to download a copy of the standard, of course, which you should do if you're transitioning anyway. You'll need to establish the documentation required by the standard, conduct training, implement the various requirements, including an internal audit, compliance evaluation, a management review. You'll need a contract with a certification body, such as PJR, to conduct the audits, and you'll also need to submit any pre-qualification information and evidence that's requested to be able to facilitate the contract identification, the calculation of audit time, and here we're referring specifically also to the contract validation audit I mentioned on the previous slide, where the certification body is doing a contract review as required by the code of practices. After that's done, the next steps are the stage one audit and the stage two audit, which I'll talk about in a moment. Any nonconformities need to be addressed before you can move on to the next stage, but after the stage two nonconformities, if there are any, are effectively closed and approved by the auditor, the package is reviewed, a certificate can then be issued. The certificate is good for 3 years. So then you enter the certification cycle, which I'll talk about in a moment. The contract validation, as I mentioned, and I do have to update that slide, ranges from a quarter day to a half day based on the whether you're transitioning from R2 2013 to R2 V3 or whether this is a new registration. The stage one audit is primarily a documentation review to make sure the framework for meeting the standard requirements is in place. We do have to issue nonconformances rather than what we would previously have called concerns based on changes to the code of practices. So this is a change for our process as well. Those need to be corrected before the stage two can proceed. The stage two audit, typically a month to 2 months after the stage one audit, we may see this change a little bit depending on how long those NCRs from the stage one take to close. But that's a full system audit. All of the requirements of the standard are going to be sampled to get a thorough sampling, a robust audit of the R2v3 requirements before a certificate can be issued to the new standard. Again, any nonconformities need to be resolved, and Siri's Code of Practices has new deadlines and expectations for that. I mentioned that the certificate is good for 3 years. Those first 2 years of the certification cycle represent the surveillance audit portion, where you may have semi-annual or annual audits based on your contract, and those are not as lengthy as the stage two audit. They would be considered partial system audits, where we're sampling some but not all of the requirements of the standard. The third year of the cycle, on the other hand, is the recertification audit, and that is very similar to the stage two in that it is a full system audit, an audit against all the requirements in the standard to try and get a really thorough sampling before a new certificate is issued as a result of that audit, and the process and the cycle starts all over. Okay, If you haven't already, please go ahead and type your questions in the question field while I put the contact information up on this slide. Again, my name is Austin Matthews. I can be contacted through the main PJR phone number as well as via email. And if I can't answer your question, if it's consulting in nature or a technical question that needs to be answered by Siri, I will let you know, but otherwise I'll do my best to assist you. If you are a new client looking for a quote or to get some information about starting the registration process, I've also included the sales department contact information on this slide. As I mentioned too, this webinar is being recorded to be published to PJR's website, and you can download a copy of the slides from PJR's website. I would give it a day or two for those to be uploaded at least. It takes a bit of time. The files are large. Okay, I don't currently have any questions. I'll hang out for another minute or two in case somebody is typing. Otherwise, if you have your transition audit coming up, I wish you the best of luck. I hope the webinar content is helpful. We continue to offer the R2V3 webinar. I believe it's every month as we continue to understand some new requirements from Siri as the code of practices and other relevant documents continue to be revised. We do our best to keep the content of the webinar updated, so feel free to check back for a future airing of this webinar to see if anything has changed. Okay. I don't see any questions, so I'm going to go ahead and sign off. Thank you so much for joining us today, and best of luck during your R2V3 audit.